Episode 287, The Cult of Sherlock.
Welcome to the Sci-Fi Christian, bringing you theology at warp speed. I'm Matt Anderson.
And I am Ben DiBono. And I'm losing my voice, but we are soldiering on.
And we're back.
Yeah, we're back.
Ben, I mean, right off the top, I just want to give you a big shout out because you actually helped me fix up my new studio here.
Yeah, you got a new computer.
A new computer, so I didn't know how to use any of the input or output stuff. You're the technical person here in this relationship. And
right.
I think you saved the day. I mean, hopefully people are hearing this.
Yeah.
If it sounds different, let us know. Feedback at thescifichristian.com. We'll try to fix it.
Yeah, but don't be like self-conscious about it. Like
I feel self-conscious.
I don't feel self-conscious.
That's good, because you're doing most of the talking tonight.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so a good combination of I don't know what's going on. Like, otherwise, I feel fine, but I woke up this morning and my voice was not doing so hot. Well, so just see what happens.
It's getting to be that time of the year where we just hit September. Yeah. Oh, we've been off the air. I mean,
for a couple of weeks.
We've posted a few episodes, but I can't remember was the last time we recorded 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago?
2 weeks ago.
Oh, that wasn't so bad.
No.
So you had a baby.
Well, my wife did.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
Little Charles.
Yeah.
Do you call him Charlie?
No, we call him Charles.
Are you going to call him Charlie?
No, I think we're going to call him Charles.
What if I want to call him Charlie?
I guess.
All right, little Charlie, Charlie Benedict.
Yeah. See, that just doesn't sound good, guys. If you're going to throw in the middle name, you got to go for the Charles.
Okay. Any good stories from the whole birthing?
Well, it came out okay.
All right.
So,
Des and I have our
first... I don't know if there's good stories from the birthing. That's kind of a weird question.
Des and I have our first birthing classes
this
weekend.
Those. Yeah.
So I'm going to learn all about the ins and outs.
Breathing exercises.
Yeah. Yeah, like I thought it was.
Oh, yeah.
That's in the TV shows usually.
Yeah, all that stuff goes out the window.
Hero's like, all right, just do your best. Breathe as normally as possible.
Nature's going to do what nature's going to do.
All right. So tell us, what does this episode entail? What does Sherlock the Great and Terrible mean?
Well, I've been listening for the last few weeks to Sherlock Holmes on audiobook. I'm an audible.com member, so I used my monthly credit to download the complete Sherlock Holmes. It's kind of, they got a little bit of a weird setup there because it's actually three volumes for the complete Sherlock Holmes, volume one, volume two, and volume three. Mm-hmm. And if you want to download volume one, it costs you one credit. If you want to download volume two, it costs you one credit, and so on to volume three for one credit as well. But if you want to download the entire Sherlock Holmes, it costs you one credit.
Really?
So if you are interested in downloading Sherlock Holmes on Audible, just get the whole thing.
Okay.
Otherwise, that'd be really stupid.
It would be.
Yeah. Wasting money.
Have you been enjoying it?
I have been enjoying it.
What brought this on?
Well,
what made you want to check out Sherlock?
Well, I mean, who doesn't like a little Sherlock life?
Yeah.
We all need a little Sherlock in your life, so... you know, and I listen while I'm biking and everything, and so I've been listening to Sherlock Holmes, and as I'm out there biking around and enjoying it, and you know, sometimes I like to literary interpretation is one of my hobbies, and I was an English major in college for my undergrad work, so it's something I know a little bit about, and sometimes I like to play a little game to come up with off-the-wall interpretations.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing that one day, and that was kind of the seed of this episode, just sort of developing a secondary reading of Sherlock Holmes with an off-the-wall interpretation. And then I started to kind of get intrigued by it, and I emailed the base idea to you, and you said, let's do it.
Yes. And
so we're doing it.
Do you want to tell them that seed of an idea now, or do you want to work your way towards it through the conversation?
Well, we'll tell it soon, but I want to maybe kind of explain... you're writing me a note.
No, I'm not. Nope. I'm just getting paper ready because I can't... All right. So in the new studio, I don't have any files ready to go where I can type notes.
Oh, okay.
So I'm preparing paper.
Preparing paper.
In case I want to maybe bring a conversation topic up during the course of conversation.
Right. Well, that's a good idea. I thought maybe you needed your headset up and were trying to tell me in a clever way.
I mean, at this point, I would have just told you because they know we have a new studio.
Right, right.
They know, you know, that things are a little bit different here, so.
So I think what I want to do, see, I'm sorry for my voice. I'm going to sound like a teenage boy this whole episode.
And we're doing three episodes after this. So
it's going to be bad news, everyone.
Just so you know, we're pre-recording some episodes to post when I leave because my baby's going to be born next month.
Yeah.
First child. So you, I mean, I know.
Number three.
You just had your third, and you guys were only in the hospital for a total of 36 hours.
In and out.
Which is crazy.
Yeah.
How long were you for your first child? Do you remember?
A couple days. I don't know.
I mean, who wanted to rush through this? Was it Annie or was it you?
Oh, we just all want to get out of there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Once you know what you're doing, it's just like, let's go home. And when you already have kids, too, it's like, you know, you get as soon as you can get back to a normal routine, the better.
Okay. Sorry. Go ahead.
All right. So I want to kind of explain the concept of secondary or alternate readings, okay? So that you kind of understand the base idea, and then I'll go into this reading that I came up with that I think is actually quite illuminating, not only about Sherlock Holmes, but about a variety of other issues we'll get into.
Okay.
So the concept of a secondary reading is that you have your primary reading, which would be essentially, what does the author intend? How does the author intend for this work to be written? Now, that can be clear or unclear, depending on the author and how much information we have and everything. But it's essentially taking the work as it is meant to be taken, a straightforward reading. An alternate or secondary reading is one that looks at the work in a way that the author didn't intend, and tries to make a case for that based on circumstantial evidence or whatnot in the work. For example, obviously, if you read Harry Potter, J.K. Rowling intended to tell the story of a boy wizard who has all sorts of wonderful adventures. But I don't know if you've seen this on Facebook that's been floating around, but there's been kind of a... It started as a Reddit post and then got edited into, you know, a series of pictures and whatever that's been posted as a link on Facebook a number of times I've seen, where somebody has come up with an alternate reading of Harry Potter where Harry Potter is actually about mental illness and Harry Potter is actually crazy and Hogwarts is a mental institution and you can Google it and read all about it. And so something like that, is that what J.K. Rowling intended? Almost certainly not. Is it an amusing way to read the book? Probably. I mean, if you're a big Harry Potter fan, that might be a fun thing to think about. So it's kind of theorizing after the fact, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally.
A couple other examples would be, you know, anytime you have a story told in the first person, it's a lot of fun to play around with the concept of the unreliable narrator. You know, which Sherlock Holmes works quite well for that.
Watson is an unreliable narrator?
Yeah, in fact, Sherlock accuses him in several stories of embellishing his writings.
Oh, okay, that's interesting.
So, yeah, I mean, to varying degrees, you could play with that. Sometimes the author very much intends for us to take a narration as unreliable. One of my favorite authors and a guy who will appear somewhere in our top 100 list, or at least in the runners-up, because I voted for him, Christopher Priest, he plays a lot in his novels with the concept of intentional paradox, where he will intentionally throw out unreliable narrators.
Okay.
If you've ever seen The Usual Suspects, mm-hmm. you know, that movie clearly does a lot with that.
Yeah.
And then also another example using Sherlock would be to read Sherlock with trying to pick up clues about exactly what his mental instability is. You know, he's clearly insane in a variety of ways. He has a number of mental issues, whether it be manic depressive or OCD, or, you know, I think the BBC show refers to him as a high functioning sociopath or something like that. You know, so to read Sherlock as an examination of mental illness, and I played around with that one a little bit, and you could almost even read that maybe Watson isn't just his casual friend, but is actually his doctor who is trying to somehow diagnose and heal him through all that. So you could play with that stuff. Okay, so that's the whole concept of secondary readings. Enough about that. The reading I came up with was I started to think, wouldn't it be fun to read Sherlock Holmes as a religious text? So this is going to be one of those conversations, you know, sometimes like we did Star Wars. Everybody's had a Star Wars episode.
Yeah.
Pretty sure no one's had an episode on really reading Sherlock Holmes as a religious text.
Right. This is a first.
The Cult of Sherlock.
That's what we should have called this.
Yeah, man.
Let's go back.
We could go back, yeah.
The Cult of Sherlock.
The Cult of Sherlock.
Sherlock the Great and Terrible is pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, there was a few good ones.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna walk through this base read, and let me just give you the rough outline of what I have planned, Matt. That's always kind of fun.
Yeah.
I'm gonna give you this base reading. I'm going to do it by highlighting several areas where Sherlock parallels religion and religious texts on the development of religion, which I think is quite interesting, but certainly circumstantial. This isn't how Arthur Conan Doyle intended for it to be written, so we are in a secondary reading. But then I'm going to get into why I think that this reading is worth considering, not as a primary reading, but as one that is still significant to our understanding of Sherlock Holmes and our attraction to him.
Okay.
And then finally, I want to get into what this reading tells us about maybe other things that we are a fan of.
Oh, okay.
Other various fandoms and how we can maybe apply its lessons to understanding other shows, characters, books, series, TV shows that we like.
Perfect. Perfect.
All right. So, obviously, at the top, we have the miracle worker, Sherlock Holmes,
mm-hmm.
who is, I don't want to call him a prophet, because I think we're going to see Watson fits more into the prophet character. But if you think about religions, many religions, whether they be cults or, you know, Christianity or whatnot, center on a central figure with some kind of supernatural ability, a miracle worker. Obviously, we see this with Jesus in the Gospels, yeah. You know, very clearly. You can see this in Mormonism with Joseph Smith. You know, he is the one who kind of receives from on high the visions of the prophet, you know, of the angels and everything. And obviously, various cults will pop up with a charismatic figure at the center who purports to work miracles. And what's very interesting about this in terms of where we can, why this becomes a not only a fun secondary reading, but somewhat plausible in terms of reading the book, is that Sherlock is frequently referred to by characters in the stories as a magician, as a sorcerer, or something mm-hmm. like that when he goes through his deductive powers. Now, of course, he isn't a supernatural character. Sherlock is a miracle worker of modernism. He exists in a purely modernist world. There is some references to his that he does believe in God, but they're very throwaway.
Did they have the concept of a psychic during the time that Sherlock was being written? I mean, they must have had clairvoyance.
Yeah, but within the world of Sherlock,
yeah,
it does not apply.
It doesn't come up.
There is no such thing as a supernatural for all intents and purposes within the world of Sherlock.
Everything can be explained through mm-hmm. science or something else.
Science, logic,
trickery,
deduction. You know, that is Sherlock's supernatural ability. It's his ability to wield the tools and powers of modernism as no one else can around him. So we have the central miracle worker. But then we also have what oftentimes you find is that the central miracle worker, however charismatic and intriguing he is to his immediate people around him, is not always the one who begins the religion, if you will. To go back to Jesus, he doesn't write the Gospels himself. In fact, for all we know, Jesus wrote nothing in mm-hmm. his time. There's somebody else who writes the Gospels. Brigham Young is to Joseph Smith. You know, you often have kind of the organizer who accompanies this central charismatic figure. I'm calling this person the prophet, and of course, this is none other than Dr. Watson mm-hmm. himself. So Watson is the Paul or gospel writer.
Wow, that really makes sense, actually.
Yeah, it does. And what's kind of fun to touch on something I touched on a moment ago, that to a certain degree, we can doubt the reliability of Watson's statements. It's actually, you can play around with that as being similar to how the relationship that scholars try, or to what scholars try and do when they try and drag the historical Jesus out of the Gospels. In other words, let's take Sherlock's claims at face value that Watson is embellishing. So then there becomes this question, just as there is with the Gospels, between how much distance is there between the Sherlock of the text and the quote unquote historical Sherlock, if okay. you will. Now, of course, the question also doesn't ultimately matter, because just as with Jesus, so it is with Sherlock, that even if Watson embellishes, even if the Gospel writers don't have every detail, last detail correct, intentionally or otherwise, the point isn't that it's a perfect biographical picture of the central character, but rather it's an attempt to represent the central miracle worker in all of his charismatic glory to the intended audience. Does that make sense?
It does.
Yeah. So the point isn't for when Watson writes what he writes, he's not trying to present us a perfect picture of the historical Sherlock, which I'm well aware his Sherlock is not a historical character, but I'm using that term as a parallel to the historical Jesus. Mm-hmm. His intention is to present to us who the person of Sherlock in his true form.
I get what you're saying. I'm glad you gave that disclaimer because I think it helped shed some light on what you're doing exactly, which is
right.
You're trying to get to, assuming Sherlock is a real person, who is he actually, even with the potential embellishments of Dr. Watson?
Well, yeah, I mean, we assume the world of the story, right? So within the world of the Sherlock Holmes stories, obviously that's not historical in the sense of it doesn't exist in the real world. But even within the world of the story, there's a difference between the texts we are presented with that Watson writes and what actually happened in that world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's the whole concept of the unreliable narrator, is to try and figure out what is the true story behind the told story. And so that's where that gimmick is a great deal of fun.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. There was also pharisaical characters within the Sherlock Holmes series.
Is it the police?
The police force. Okay. Yeah.
No, I haven't. I should say I've seen the TV show, but I haven't. Oh, and I've seen two movies, but I have not read any Sherlock literature.
Yeah.
Sorry.
That's okay. I mean, we're going to get to why that's actually okay in a little bit.
Okay.
Even though I do recommend reading the original stories or listening to them.
I should just join Audible.
You should.
So how much does it cost per year?
I don't know. Per year, it's like $12-13 bucks a month.
Okay.
Download a book
once
a month.
Just one book per month?
Yeah.
Okay.
You can sign up for more. Like, they have like a $20 plan for two books a month.
Okay. All right. I'll have to come back to that.
Yeah, it's awesome. So the Pharisees. The Pharisees, of course, in the gospel are those who should embrace Jesus but don't. They should be his closest allies but ultimately are not. And we see that in Sherlock, although, to be honest, the police in Sherlock are far more sympathetic than the Pharisees are in the Gospels, mm-hmm. but they fulfill this similar role, where, especially in the early stories, they are the doubters. They are those who should be Sherlock's biggest advocates and allies, but instead they enlist his help very grudgingly. They doubt him along the way. They frequently put their own theories out there, and when Sherlock contradicts them, they meet him with a degree of hostility. Even after they become converted, if you will, mm-hmm. they still regard him with suspicion. They still don't embrace him as they ought to. And that's very much the story of the Pharisees in the Gospels, and really of all the religious leaders as they're presented in the Gospels, of those who ought to be Jesus's biggest advocates because he is the messianic figure they've been waiting for, but ultimately oppose him and get in his way more often than not and fail to understand him. And so it is with Sherlock.
Perfect.
We have a devil figure.
A devil figure. But in this case, isn't Sherlock's devil figure more of an equal rather than the Satan figure, which is not an equal?
Perhaps, but of course Sherlock always beats him, doesn't he?
Moriarty.
Now, this is very interesting, Matt. Do you want to know how many stories Moriarty appears in?
I'm going to guess. It must be low because of the way you're talking. I'm going to guess two.
One.
That, I was going to guess one, but I thought, no, that's too small.
Now, he's referenced a number of times.
Okay.
But he only actually appears as the villain in one story. Now, this actually forms an even more interesting parallel to Christianity because, as you know, the devil, despite how large he looms in Christian theology, is a very scarce character within the scriptures.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And so, same with Moriarty. Now, this gets even more interesting. Now, I have not read this story yet, slight spoilers, but in the story that Moriarty appears, is the one where Sherlock Holmes appears to die.
Oh, I actually know the title of this, but I won't say
The Final Problem.
Oh, I thought that wasn't... What's the one about the falls of...
No, you're thinking of the... That's the name that it is in the TV series.
Exactly.
So the same type of thing happens.
I thought the TV series kept the same titles as the book series.
No, they oftentimes will like play off of a title.
The Study of Pink, wasn't that one?
The first Sherlock Holmes novel is called The Study in Scarlet. So they kind of play off of it. There's the Sign of the Four, Sign of the Three. So they...
Okay.
It's a loose adaptation.
Okay, gotcha.
Now, Sherlock also resurrects, though, in the next story. He comes back to life. Now, of course, it's a modernist resurrection. He faked his death and everything. Mm-hmm. But yet, that is the victory over Moriarty, just as Jesus' victory over the devil isn't that he's an equal who gets beaten. It's that he comes back.
Just got that.
Yeah.
There it is.
There it is.
He's like a Jesus figure.
Yes.
I think that's what you're trying to say.
Very much so. Yeah. Very much so. Now, what gets even more fascinating is that, of course, one important element of religion, as we develop from the central text, is a sense of liturgy. All religions have liturgy in one degree or another. Even within Protestant circles that would be considered non-liturgical, there is a sense of liturgy. You know, you have your singing at the beginning, you have your sermon, you have at least a loose Christian calendar with Christmas, Easter, all of that stuff. And so liturgy does appear in one degree or another in virtually all religions, and many times quite significantly. And it's the same way with Sherlock. Once you start reading several stories, you really start to pick up on the liturgy of Sherlock. That what we see is Sherlock is presented with an improbable scenario. He comes up with a crazy theory. Let me back up. He's presented with the impossible scenario. Mm-hmm. He's told a story, given a case that seems to defy explanation or seems to suggest an explanation other than what the true answer will ultimately be. Watson and Sherlock will oftentimes have almost word for word the same conversation, where Watson will say, "I don't know what you can do with this, Holmes, blah, 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 blah." And Sherlock goes, What don't you get, Watson? You saw everything I did. And Watson goes, "No, I didn't see everything." And Sherlock will say something along the lines of, "You saw, but you didn't deduce. You didn't reason." Yeah. You know, and so there's this almost liturgical back and forth, just as there is within actual religious liturgy that takes place.
Ben, this is crazy.
I know. Isn't this wild? And on it goes, as, you know, then Sherlock will do his chains of deduction. He'll do improbable and often eccentric types of investigation, whether it's disguises, whatnot. He'll usually be doubted along the way and then, in the end, produce an improbable result, presenting us with the height of the Sherlockian liturgy, which is his chain of deduction.
Oh, yeah.
In which we get to trace his logic and see how it actually all makes sense, even though it feels virtually impossible.
I have a question for you. I've heard some people complain that the resolution, there's no way a reader could have ever helped solve that. Like, only Sherlock could figure it out in that world. Is that true, or are there clues along the way for the reader?
It depends on the story. There's some you can figure out.
Okay.
Along the way. But that's actually kind of the point, is that even though Sherlock, presumably, we ought to be able to do everything he does, because he is purely modernist, he's also beyond us. You know, we are not him. He is the miracle worker of the religion. We don't get to his level.
Okay.
You know.
So, it was Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, correct?
Yes.
Now, after he died, did anybody continue writing this character?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's the most adapted character in all of fiction.
I mean, immediately after. Like, you know how right now, here's an example. Once the guy, Robert Ludlum, who did the Bourne series, once he died, they kept on doing Bourne series. And they just say, I think it still has Robert Ludlum's name on it, but it says by
right.
a different. Yeah,
yeah, so same thing's going on with Tom Clancy.
Yeah. So did that happen right away for Doyle?
I don't think so.
Or was it after it was more in the, what is it called, public domain?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what the copyright laws were exactly back then.
Yeah.
But certainly throughout the 20th century, you know, as it was adapted and readapted and readapted. And that gets to an important point, that Arthur Conan Doyle and his subsequent adapters really function then as the liturgists. They are the ones who enact the liturgy. They are the priests who stand up, and they don't form the liturgy that is formed, you know, and again, we're operating secondary reading here. So clearly Conan Doyle did invent this formula and all of this. But within this reading, they don't invent it. They simply enact it. They are the ones who bring us the liturgical form of Watson's texts. They are the ones who present us the liturgy of Sherlock's cases. And that's, you see that good. All the way down to the BBC series today. Now, I mentioned, we were talking a minute ago about how faithful is it. Well, it's not faithful in details, but it's certainly faithful in the liturgy. You know, it's faithful in that formula of everything that I just described. You can recognize it very clearly within the BBC series. I don't know about the Robert Downey Jr. movies because I haven't seen them. But that whole sense of seemingly impossible case, you know, conversations about how can you possibly see that, Sherlock explaining, leading to this incredible chain of deduction that we're ultimately rewarded with. It's the same liturgy. It's the same formula. It doesn't matter if all the details of the story are different. What matters is that the central tenets of the faith are upheld in the new adaptations.
This is honestly crazy. I mean, and you came up with all this just while biking?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is fun.
Yeah.
This is why it's fun to think of secondary readings. It's like you get to do all this wild stuff. Now, of course, a central figure like Sherlock or like Jesus deserves worship. So how is Sherlock worshipped within the series? Now, you could say we worship him by reading him, but that's too easy.
Okay.
Within the series itself, this is very interesting. Sherlock is very ambivalent about money. People will offer to pay him and he won't turn it down. But what he wants is stories. He wants the details. So after he does his chain of deduction, he wants the rest filled in, the undeducible filled in. And it becomes the stories behind these cases are what he ultimately demands for his services. They become the form of worship and response within the liturgical rite.
Can you give me an example?
For example, The Sign of the Four, which is the second Sherlock Holmes novel. I won't give away the whole mystery because that might be considered the cardinal sin of the Sherlockian religion, of course.
Yeah.
but at the end of it, you know, Sherlock's apprehended the criminal and he's done his amazing deductions and everything. And he tells the police, I'm going to help you, but what I want in return is I want an hour or two alone with this guy to hear his entire story.
Okay.
And that formula repeats itself repeatedly throughout the stories, is that he demands the answers. That's what he wants. That's what he wants. Is not payment. He doesn't want money. He doesn't want prestige. He wants the stories. Wow. And the details.
Quick side tangent.
Yeah.
Going back to Audible. So you've been listening to all these stories straight through. You said you downloaded the complete collection.
Yeah.
Which, how many books are there total by Doyle?
Oh, I don't know. There's four novels and then four or five short story collections.
Okay. So when you download the complete collection, you get everything.
Yeah.
And it sounds like they're a little bit short. Are the novels, do they tend to be short?
Yeah, I think the first two novels are like take like 4 hours or something.
Each?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then the short stories are usually somewhere between 40 minutes and an hour.
Oh, so maybe one long bike ride, knock one out.
Yeah, I usually get through about two-ish on a bike ride, which is kind of nice.
Okay, yeah. Sorry.
Now, are you familiar with John Henry Newman?
No.
Well, he was an Anglican, a bishop who eventually became a Catholic cardinal, and his major work, or one of his major works, is The Development of Christian Doctrine, in which he lays out the way that doctrine develops over time, and it's quite a brilliant work, and I would need to review it to give a more detailed summary, but essentially the essence of it is we know that doctrine develops. In fact, that's an important part of Catholicism, and indeed of many religions, which is why I'm mentioning it here. But how does doctrine develop in a way that allows for changes, but not for the overturning or kind of an anything goes mentality? You know, how do you navigate that? If you say, because it seems like the argument against that would be the second you say doctrine develops, it seems like anything goes. So how do we navigate that? What does a faithful development look like as compared to an unfaithful development? And it's a brilliant work, and you can apply it to, I believe, virtually all religions in the way that doctrine develops over time. And using this work, you can trace faithful developments and unfaithful developments. Well, the Sherlockian religion is, of course, no exception to this, in that doctrine also develops in the Sherlock religion. Let me list a few elements of the Sherlock mythos that you will probably be familiar with.
Okay.
What does Sherlock wear on his head? What's his typical hat?
Actually, I don't know. Is it? I know I can picture it, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's the deerstalker cap.
Okay.
Now, can you also picture the type of pipe that he wears? He usually smokes.
Just
roughly. It's kind of a long, winding.
Yeah, yep. Like this.
Curves around. Yeah. Yep. And then finally, what's one of his most famous slogans?
Oh, yeah. It's elementary.
My dear Watson.
My dear Watson.
None of those three appear in the original stories.
Really?
Yes.
The hat?
The hat is not there. Sherlock is never mentioned wearing
the deerstalker
hat. He
doesn't say elementary, my dear Watson? Never. Where did that even come from?
Well, we'll get there. It's the development of Sherlockian doctor.
Okay.
Right? So, the deerstalker cap. Sherlock's never described wearing that. It's a complete embellishment that occurs in the Basil Rathbone films.
Okay.
Ditto with the pipe. Now, Sherlock does smoke and use cocaine in the original stories.
What? He uses cocaine?
Yeah.
How does that come up into the story?
See, that's part of, if you were to do a mental illness reading, that would be a major part, because we're told that Sherlock alternates between this kind of manic energy where he hardly eats, hardly sleeps, and just works, 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 and times where he will just sit in his recliner and do absolutely nothing for a week and be smoking cocaine or snorting cocaine all this stuff. So you could use that to establish or to attempt to establish kind of a manic depressive attitude to him, or, you know, bipolar personality or something like that. So yeah, Sherlock Holmes, cocaine addict.
Okay.
though what's interesting is that he has no trouble putting it away when he is on a case. So he's not addicted to it except for when he is off the case. But that would be a very different reading of the stories.
Okay.
Which is another lesson about secondary readings, is that they are ultimately very selective in their details.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so something like that doesn't support the reading or is more difficult to fit into it is left aside in a secondary reading. And that's just part of the game. That's why you don't consider them primary readings.
Okay.
They don't take into account enough of the stories to say this is what Arthur Conan Doyle intended.
Okay.
So now he does smoke, though. He does, and he uses a variety of pipes. He's said to use a clay pipe the most often, a briarwood pipe, and a cherrywood pipe. But what's interesting is that, and I wouldn't expect you as a non-pipe smoker to know this, mm-hmm. Matt, but the distinctive Sherlock Holmes pipe is actually a calabash pipe. Mm. It's made out of a gourd. It's a very distinct style of pipe, and Sherlock Holmes never smokes that type of pipe in the stories. Now, you could say that's a small detail, but to a pipe enthusiast, which we know Sherlock is, because he writes a monograph on pipe tobacco or pipe ashes.
Wait, what do you mean?
He writes like a academic work studying the different types of tobacco ashes.
That's mentioned in one of the books?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, he's famous for it. okay. He's obsessive about it. And so this is somebody who is very obsessive about pipes and never smokes a calabash, even though that is his most distinct form of smoking or of pipe that when you, in the Sherlock mythos. What was that?
What was that sound for, Ben?
Well, we're actually recording this part of the episode a week later.
1 week. So, listeners, sorry, you didn't get an episode last week.
Yeah, that's what happens.
So, Ben,
sure what happened, but bad things.
Well, with the new setup, we can blame it on my new computer. Yeah. We have the new computer. Ben helped me set it up.
Mac. Just want to throw that out there.
Yeah, it is a Mac, but yeah. I don't think it wasn't the Mac that caused the badness. It was some sort of setting that I had for the audio. So, yeah.
We're hoping.
So there was 13 minutes of this recording that we did last week that is literally unusable.
Yeah, completely. But it actually kind of works out good for you guys because we are, you know, I was talking about some of the embellishments and we'll finish up with that. But we also read the Facebook responses during this section that got messed up. And some of you responded after we finished recording. So now everyone gets to
Everybody's
be included.
In.
How about that?
So we'll do that. And then we will the end of the episode still works fine. So we're going to flash back with a sound effect. And then you can hear the end of our conversation from last week.
Yeah, there might be a 30 seconds or so after when we flash back where it's not great, but you can still hear it. And that's just because we transitioned to a topic and it got better very quickly thereafter.
Excellent, Ben. So Let's have a fresh conversation. So just go ahead, say your things, and I'll react in a different way than I did last week.
Okay. And while I'm doing that, can you pull up some Facebook action and find that post?
Guess what? Already did.
Oh, you're amazing.
Thank you.
So we were talking about embellishments to Sherlock. And obviously, I don't need to do a whole reset because you guys just heard that conversation.
Yeah.
So the one that I was talking about when things went out is the fact that Sherlock in the books never smokes his famous calabash pipe, which is so iconic to his character.
That's right. And you had mentioned that maybe I shouldn't repeat anything. You just go ahead. Just take
it away. I'll just go? Okay.
Just go, yeah.
So he smokes at a, you know, and I don't know when we'll drop it in, so I'll just repeat this part, that this calabash pipe is kind of that long, curvy pipe. It's a pipe material made out of a gourd. And
he was a pipe aficionado, you said.
Absolutely, yeah. He writes that monograph on pipe ash or tobacco ashes. In fact, that he uses that, his obsessive knowledge of tobacco ashes, to solve a couple cases where he's able to tell that somebody here was smoking this type of cigar and using a cigar holder to do it and, you know, that type of thing. So he said in the novel he does smoke pipes, both he and Watson do, but in the books he smokes a clay pipe quite a bit, a briar pipe, but never, never a calabash. Little embellishment action.
Dang.
And then the other one, the last one that I was going to mention here, is his most famous slogan, Matt. And I asked you what this was, and you guessed it correctly last time, so see if you can guess again.
Elementary, my dear Watson.
Yeah, he never says that phrase in the books.
That is very surprising.
Yeah.
Because there, I mean, everybody says that when they think of Sherlock. Plus, I mean, even things like the CBS show is called Elementary, the CBS version of Sherlock.
Now, Sherlock does say elementary at different times, and he does call Watson my dear Watson at various times, but he never says that phrase. That phrase does not exist in the Arthur Conan Doyle stories.
Yeah, that's weird.
So these were, you know, as you guys all know, and I'm just trying to refresh my memory here, but these were examples of the way that things develop. And I believe I talked a little bit about John Henry Newman at the top of this section. And so just as religions are apt to develop in their doctrine in various embellishments, so we see the same thing with Sherlock. And I want to throw out a couple of parallels to that within the Christian faith. So, Matt, how was the Apostle Peter traditionally said to be executed?
Yeah, I think that our traditions say that Peter was crucified upside down.
But you won't find that anywhere in the Bible or even in official church teaching.
That's right.
Same thing for if we look at what was Mary Magdalene's profession.
Yes, it's often said that she was a prostitute.
Well, if you search through the Gospels, you're not going to find any reference to her being a prostitute.
That's actually one that I bet really tricks people, because the crucified upside down, a lot of people have heard that, but I don't know. That's not in the Bible necessarily. I mean, it's not in the Bible. And so no one thinks it's in the Bible. But I bet a lot of people think that the Mary Magdalene thing is in the Bible.
Right. Yeah. So you have stuff like that. It's very common in faith. And so it works well with our reading of Sherlock as a religious text. So here's what we're going to do then. That's kind of all I have for dissecting the various elements. We'll go into the Facebook stuff. I will talk then about the significance of this reading, why I think it's worthwhile. And then from there, we'll be able to transition back into the part we recorded last week that did not get messed up. So,
all right, here we go.
What do we got on Facebook? I reread the question because I don't remember what I asked.
So last week, Ben posted on Facebook and he asked the question of the day, what is your favorite incarnation, and this can be book, movie, show, etc., of Sherlock Holmes? Why do you think the character remains so popular after so long? Most people just said what their favorite version of Sherlock is. So I'll start with, I remember last week we had an argument over this. Is it Mikey or Mickey?
Pretty sure it's Mickey.
I say Mikey. So Mikey says, hands down, the radio show from the 90s that adapted all of ACD's stories. In case you don't know, ACD, Arthur Conan Doyle. How good was it?
I think
they even made sense of The Creeping Man. And at last week, you hadn't read The Creeping Man yet.
Still haven't gotten to it.
Okay.
Yeah.
You want to read Seth, or are you not there yet?
I'm not there yet, so you keep going for more.
I do want to say, I think that, and I don't know if I do this in the 13 minutes that we're now extracting or in the other parts of the show, but I had referred to Arthur Conan Doyle as Doyle. Just going, but that's not his last name. His last name is Conan Doyle. Is that correct?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
Maybe.
All right.
All right, I got here.
Let's read on. Seth.
Wait, okay. Oh, it would make sense to ask for full disclosure about how broad our experiences of Sherlock are. For instance, I give the nod to the new Sherlock show, but I've never read the original stories and books, found the newish movies kind of Michael Bay-ish, and Robert Downey Jr.'s accent was crappy.
Since you've been reading the books now, do you have any interest in seeing these movies? Because since you've never seen the two Sherlock movies with Robert Downey Jr.?
Maybe a little. I don't know. I like Guy Ritchie. I think he's an interesting director.
I don't know that... If I had to guess, my guess would be you won't like them.
Probably not.
But... It would be nice for you, I bet, just to see how do they adapt certain elements from the stories.
Yeah, but then again, there's like a million different Sherlock adaptations out there. He is the most adapted character in history.
That's true. I don't believe they have any plans for a third one at this point, so we'll see. Ethan Irway wrote on our Facebook page, "The show with Benedict Cumberbatch and the Robert Downey Jr. movies are both great. I still love the original works as well. The stories hold up so well because they are intriguing and well thought out. Who wouldn't want to have the deductive reasoning skills that Holmes displays, and seeing things through the relatable character of Watson makes spending time with Holmes bearable and even more important, enjoyable."
Yeah.
Now, I don't want to keep pausing and reflecting on what we may or may not have talked about in the episode so far, but do you remember when we may have mentioned the different types of, or maybe like the Sherlock archetypes, you know, I'm talking about like psych and mentalist. Have we already talked about that earlier in this episode? Or
I think that's later.
So I'm going to talk about, well, yeah, just in case. I might be talking later about psych. I might be talking about...
The House.
Yeah, House, the Doctor show, which... and I mentioned this to you and you didn't know this. So this is the only Sherlock fact I knew that Ben didn't know, which is that Sherlock is based on a doctor who Conan Doyle knew.
Yeah.
And then House is based on Sherlock. So ultimately, big circle.
Right.
All right, go ahead.
Daniel writes that his favorite is the BBC show, and he includes a wonderful picture of a squirrel dressed up like Sherlock Holmes.
Oh.
Thank you. Keep the squirrel pictures coming, everyone. I love them all.
Trevor wrote in and said, "Benedict Cumberbatch," followed by Scott, who says, "The original works, hands down."
Michael says, "I prefer the current BBC adaptation. As far as Seth goes, I saw some old black and white movie when I was a kid and read a book or two before the Robert Downey Jr. movie and current show came out."
And John Wilkerson says, "I think the current BBC incarnation is the best. While it doesn't hold the traditional character in, it's modern and makes a lot of calls back to original classic stories."
Paul Lewis says, "I haven't seen anything recent. I read some of the old books. Does anybody remember Young Sherlock Holmes from 1985? It seemed pretty good when I was a kid. Make of that what you will."
Michael Poteet writes that, "Other than the Conan Doyle canon, BBC Sherlock, I'm also very fond of the Sir John Gielgud radio adaptation of A Scandal in Bohemia."
Yeah.
He then said to Mickey, "Is that radio show
alternate?
Is that radio show available anywhere these days?"
Well, we'll get to Mickey's answer in a minute. But first, Adam says, "Actual original Sherlock Holmes, I think." Well, it's more a preference question, Adam. Say that definitively. "I haven't really read much else, and the derivative stuff hasn't impressed me much."
And Mikey gets back to Michael with his question.
Not Mikey. Mickey. Why would anybody spell Mikey with a C?
I'm pretty sure...
We have somebody who listens to us called Mickey.
I know. The reason that I'm saying this is I think he once wrote into the show and corrected us. I think.
Well, he'll have to do it again.
Sorry.
And explain the presence of that C.
Mickey then says, "Good question, Michael, about is the radio show available anywhere these days? I'll do some digging to find it again. When I listened a few years ago, I think BBC Radio might have been rerunning them on their website." All right, so let's see. Does he ever find out down here? I don't know if he ever does come back to it.
No.
Okay. You want to read some more of what he says?
Well, he says, "Anyway, Clive Merrison played Holmes with a devilish camp and swagger, which must have influenced the modern screen versions. Gielgud's radio Holmes is excellent. I'm also fond of the 50s TV version. It's over the top, but usually good fun. The one interpretation I can never quite get into is Peter Cushing's, also known as Grand Moff Tarkin for all you Star Wars guys.
Yeah.
That is sad because he's one of my favorite actors and an admitted Sherlockian. The two films and TV series he was in just never quite got it right.
What's a Sherlockian? Just a person into Sherlock?
Like a Whovian.
Okay. Yeah. Like a Losty?
No, I don't think that's a term.
Okay. Patrick says, for some reason, the question reminded me of an old TV show I used to watch. And he references, I kind of remember this, but I don't think I ever watched it. Did you watch the mystery where a dog would help solve crimes called Wishbone?
I know the name, but no.
Me?
That sounds like a dumb show.
Oh, I think it's like a PBS like show for kids, so I bet it's not dumb for the right audience.
Well, neither is Dora the Explorer, but it's still crap.
And Patrick concludes and says, however, I would actually say that the newest BBC incarnation is the best. The original stories are fun for their own sake, but the character seems almost one-dimensional compared to the TV show. I'm sure many disagree.
All right.
Do you disagree?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was getting back to my notes.
No, it's okay. I'll give you the question. He says that the Benedict Cumberbatch Sherlock is not one-dimensional, while the Conan Doyle Sherlock is one-dimensional, and so that's why he likes the BBC version better.
Oh, I'd completely disagree. I think that especially if you read the Conan Doyle stories carefully, Benedict Cumberbatch is drawing almost all of the small mannerisms from his performance directly out of the books. So okay. I think that there's very little difference between the Benedict Cumberbatch incarnation and the Sherlock of the books. You might just have to read a little carefully because it's not, you know, it's written 100 years ago. So it's presented in a way that might not make that that fact readily apparent to modern audiences, but it's definitely there if you read it carefully.
Okay.
All right. Well, should we get back to the next part of this section before we turn it back over to past Matt and Ben?
Yes.
So the other part that we lost was a little bit of discussion here about why I think that this reading matters. Why is this more than just fun? You know, what does this tell us about why we like Sherlock Holmes? And the first point that I want to start with here, and all of you Sherlock fans, I know that I'm among you, so just wait before you jump on me for this one. But the first point I want to say is that Arthur Conan Doyle's writing, the quality of his writing, is not what attracts us to Sherlock Holmes. Arthur Conan Doyle is a very average writer. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean that his ability with language, his ability to construct a well-written story is simply not there. He's a brilliant creator in the sense that he creates people like Holmes and Watson. He creates this amazing liturgy or this formula that we've referred to earlier. But his actual skills as a writer are not there. If you take Sherlock out, take out the Sherlock elements from the stories, you're not left with much to commend about these. In other words, if Arthur Conan Doyle was to sit down and write a novel without a character like Sherlock at the center of it, it's doubtful that we would be that interested in reading it. It would be a very average novel. He frequently cheats using coincidence and stuff like that, and he's just not a great wordsmith. He's not a great a writer in any sense of the word. And I would almost compare him to, and this is probably going to get people mad as well, but I'd compare him to the opposite of somebody like a C.S. Lewis, where I think C.S. Lewis is a brilliant writer, but a very unoriginal creator. You know, you look at like Narnia, well, he's pulling on Christian allegory and myth and all of this stuff.
Technically supposal.
Right. We won't have that debate again. But, you know, it's like, but there's so much, if you read Narnia with a deaf ear to the quality of the writing, you'll walk away with a ton of criticisms of the story itself and the creation itself, but it's the quality of the writing that draws us in. And Arthur Conan Doyle is the exact opposite. It's the quality of the creation that makes us look the other way when it comes to the quality of the writing. So what does that tell us then? Well, it's that the stories then are not worthwhile. Our attraction to Sherlock is not its literary value. It's something else. And I would argue that Sherlock, Watson, and the liturgy that we've talked about are actually the draw to these stories and to this character. It's also why I think Sherlock's been able to survive through so many different adaptations. Not to say that there aren't bad adaptations of Holmes. There certainly could be. But all it takes to write a good Sherlock Holmes story, and I hope I don't repeat this later in the episode, I might, but you guys can decide which time I make my point more effectively. It's a little fun. It is a good grasp of the central characters and a good grasp of the formula. And at that point, all you need is competent storytelling. You don't need to be a good story writer. I think that's why somebody like Stephen Moffat, who's not a particularly great story writer, has been able to create such an effective Sherlock Holmes series for the BBC. Why? Because Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman are perfect in those roles. And then after that, you just construct the formula, the mysteries, and the rest kind of writes itself. It works quite well. So what I'm trying to say then with the importance of this reading is that we are drawn to Sherlock not by its literary value, but out of what I would call a kind of religious energy. That doesn't mean that we're committing idolatry by enjoying Sherlock, but it comes out of that same place. So reading Sherlock as a religious text kind of betrays the fact that we're drawn more because we are swept into the liturgy of the character, into the elements of the story that hit on our religious energy and our religious impulses, and that is what actually draws us into the character of Holmes. That's the value, then, is the way that it touches on those things. It becomes a weird mix of religion and literature that doesn't replace either, but touches on both in a way that becomes very attractive to us. So reading this as a religious text can actually tell us a lot of where that attraction to a character like Holmes is coming from. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, I think at this point, we're up to about where we left off. If we're not, I'll just throw out a couple other points to kind of transition us. So where we're going next, just in case we lose a little bit of this, I don't think we do, but just in case, is that where we're going to go next then is to compare Sherlock Holmes to fandom at large. And where we're going to start to cut in on the conversation is you're going to then hear me start to compare Sherlock Holmes and what we've just talked about to Doctor Who, and I'll extrapolate that more. My basic premise in that section, in case this gets cut off at the beginning, is going to be that Sherlock, not only that type of reading not only gives us a clue into why we like Sherlock, but also a clue into why we like fandom in general, and the way that fandom is then a reading fandom, experiencing fandom type things like Doctor Who, like Sherlock, is coming from a very fundamentally different impulse than the reading of literature. And we'll go on to extrapolate what's good and bad and about that and where some of the potential pitfalls are.
Nice, Ben. Well, thanks for going over that again. We've never done this before. I think we've lost audio before, but we just decided to forget about re-recording things.
Right.
But we've never lost a whole episode before, so that still stands.
Yeah.
But we've somehow managed to get, when things have went wrong, we've somehow managed to get the audio from a different source. Like maybe in the old days, we used to use a video camera.
Yeah.
And so we had video camera audio, but so this is the first time we've actually went back and re-recorded something, but you felt like it was that important. We had to do it.
Oh, yeah. I mean that was like right in the middle. You can't just cut that out.
Not just that, but this idea is so original and so cool that you're talking through. And like I mentioned before, I definitely want to try to do something like this again where you look at something that's commonly known through different eyes. So, all right, let me go hit some music.
We could even do another Sherlock one. There's a ton out there.
Totally. So I'll hit some music, and then we will move on to the next thing we have to re-record.
All right.
Here we go. See you guys.
Okay, goodbye. First of all, I want to talk a little bit about... let me back up. I think then from that starting point, we can actually say a lot of very interesting things about fandom in general. Okay.
Okay.
And I want to draw a parallel to what we've just talked about and Doctor Who.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So Doctor Who, the attraction to watching that show is the Doctor.
It can't be the storytelling.
It's definitely not the storytelling.
Yeah. I think both Ben and I agree. It's not the storytelling.
Right. It's not the writing at all, which even when it's at its best
is pretty average when it moves away from being focused on the Doctor. Mm-hmm. Same thing with Sherlock. In the stories, the more Arthur Conan Doyle goes off and starts talking about things besides Sherlock and beside, you know, the backgrounds to the cases or whatever might be interesting, but the farther away we get from Sherlock and what he's doing and that central liturgy, the less interesting they become. For example, the first novel, A Study in Scarlet, has a very long digression in the second half involving Mormons in Utah. Now,
what?
You just have to read it to make sense.
Okay.
And it's interesting in the sense that it tells us the motives of the villains, but we spend so long away from Sherlock that it ultimately really hurts the story.
Hmm.
Same thing with Doctor Who. It's that, okay, you know, the various plots or whatever are really nothing more than a way for the Doctor to do what the Doctor does and for us to explore his character. I know you haven't watched the current season yet.
I haven't.
So I won't spoil anything, of course, but that's been very true so far this season.
That they haven't focused on the Doctor as much?
No, but where Peter Capaldi has been fantastic.
Oh.
And the plots and writing around him have been awful.
Okay.
Absolutely atrocious.
I mean, since you are using the Doctor Who example, I think we should say there is one episode that doesn't focus on the Doctor, that's great, and that's Blink. The first episode with the Weeping Angels. But
that's true.
I think, in general, what you're saying applies.
It's the exception, though, not the rule. You know,
I just wanted to get that out, because there's somebody out there listening.
Well, what about Blink?
What about Blink?
Yeah, yeah.
It's the best episode.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking generalization, so we're not, you know, none of this is going to apply in every case for every instance of fandom across the board. And I'll touch on that itself in a minute. But what we also see with Doctor Who is that you could do a similar reading to this. Maybe not in all the details, I don't know. But there's certainly a liturgy to Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is traveling with the companions and blah, 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 blah. And the more that the stories... all you have to do to do good with writing Doctor Who is understand the character and understand the liturgy. And I think part of why Stephen Moffat has been criticized the last couple years is that his long, overly complex season-long arcs really move away from that liturgy and are trying to... we're kind of forcing Doctor Who to become something it wasn't.
Hmm.
He was moving away from what the religion of Doctor Who ought to be.
That's interesting, because I think in general, myself and I believe you as well, usually like the long, drawn-out stories that are... I mean, not drawn-out into boredom, but where it's not just a one-off story, where we like that there's some build to it.
Yeah.
But maybe in the case of Doctor Who, and maybe Sherlock,
yeah,
it's better just to focus on the characters and their individual adventures instead of some big mythology.
Right. The liturgy was established apart from those long, overdrawn storylines. A 15-episode Sherlock story or whatever wouldn't work. You know, that's part of why the BBC show has been successful, is even when there have been season-long arcs, it's 3 episodes, and then, you know, we're done.
Mm-hmm.
They focus on the individual case. That's the strength of Sherlock,
mm-hmm.
and it's ultimately the strength of Doctor Who. Now, another parallel, and I'll be curious to see what you think of this one.
Okay.
Stan Lee is very much similar to Arthur Conan Doyle.
In what way?
Average writer, brilliant creator.
Okay.
If Stan Lee was to sit down and write a novel about superheroes, it could very well be the worst thing ever written. But yet the man created some of the most entertaining characters and engaging scenarios that have been thought up in the last 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's that same impulse that Arthur Conan Doyle showed, where Arthur Conan Doyle is not a good writer. He's just not. And don't hear me saying that means he's not worth reading. Just like it doesn't mean Stan Lee isn't worth reading.
Mm-hmm.
It just means that their value isn't literature. Their value isn't in the writing, you know, in the way that somebody like Tolkien is, where you can just kind of sit and absorb the language and the form and you know, you're in the hands of a master.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the case with Arthur Conan Doyle. It's not the case with Stan Lee. But Stan Lee's strength was in his ability to create intriguing character after intriguing character and build an empire off of mm-hmm. that. And you even see that reflected in the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies, right? And the attraction isn't the storytelling, which has been pretty average. The attraction is seeing being drawn into the world of these characters in a new way, right?
Yeah, I think the movies vary on accomplishing good stories, but
exactly.
It is the characters that are drawing people in.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't mean they're all bad across the board.
Yeah.
But it's the same as what we've talked about with Sherlock and Doctor Who. It doesn't mean every Doctor Who episode is horribly written, but it does mean that, you know, you take the Doctor out, the story would fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
Not just because you don't have a central character, but because nothing else there is good enough to support watching that apart from him. You take Tony Stark and the Hulk and Thor out of that world and everything falls apart. You know, you don't have an intriguing enough story there. The literary value isn't there in the same way that it is with other characters. Now, at times, this is where it gets complicated, is that you can cross over into more of a literary value. For example, Nolan's Dark Knight trilogy. I think you take Batman out of that and you could still have, you still have an intriguing explanation of themes, of stories, and scenarios and all of that. Even if you take the Batman elements out, you still have a solid literary construction mm-hmm. there. And I'm sure there's parallels in Marvel. I'm just not as familiar with them.
Yeah.
But by and large, Batman would be the same type of thing. You know, people don't go out and buy every Batman comic book because they're expecting to read a literary masterpiece. They buy every Batman comic book because they want Batman.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a fundamental difference.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
So what then do we take away from that? Like, what does that then tell us about the way we engage with fandom?
Wait, I want you to ask that question again, but first,
yeah,
let me ask you this question. This will be my contribution to the episode. If BBC was willing, would you want to see a Sherlock Doctor Who team up movie or team up TV show? Or actually, I have an idea how this could happen, but first I'll get your answer.
I would love to see a Sherlock in Doctor Who. Like, I think that would be cool.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to see our Sherlock, meaning Benedict Cumberbatch, in that continuity crossover with Doctor Who.
Okay, this is how they could do it. All right, let's say it's a crossover. You could have Peter Capaldi and whoever his companion is at the time in the Sherlock episode, but they still play it straight, just like a Sherlock. You don't see the sci-fi or Doctor Who-ish aspects of this character. He's just introduced, and it's totally non-supernatural, non-magical, non-sci-fi.
Yeah.
But he's there, and the viewers know who he is. Okay.
Right.
Then, in the Doctor Who episode, you kind of see things more from his perspective and what was actually happening a little bit behind the scenes. So it would have to be in two chunks that together would tell a full story instead of one overall movie. That's how it could happen. That way you can keep Sherlock still, have it be, you know, straight deductive reasoning.
Yeah.
And have, but then have maybe like some fun Peter Capaldi stuff behind the scenes on Doctor Who.
I think that engages in one of the worst aspects of fandom, though, which is the ridiculous crossovers. You have to go watch the other thing to get the whole story. And oh, I hate
and
it.
And you hate shared universes.
I do, yeah.
The Moffat-verse.
You know how they should do it if they want to do it? Cast Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman in a period version of Sherlock.
Okay.
Within Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Do it that way.
Okay.
Like, have it be not within the Sherlock continuity, but go ahead and use the same actors just for fun.
Okay.
That would be the way I'd support doing it.
But. All right. Can you re-ask that last question? I know it's getting...
All right.
It was heading towards the wrap-up, and I had to get that in there before
it was too late. So I said, what do we take away from this? And what does this teach us about fandom, about the way we interact with characters like Sherlock and... Doctor Who, Batman, whoever your hero du jour is, you know, or whatever you enjoy. How do we interact with those? What can a reading like this tell us about that? Okay. Well, I want to suggest a couple different things. First, I think that we need to accept, in light of what we've just described, if you buy into what we've been talking about, at least in large pieces, we need to accept that fandom, meaning Sherlock, Batman, etc., operates in a very different realm and out of different impulses than classical storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So, classical storytelling is attempting to engage with the human tradition. It's attempting to engage with form, with literary excellence, with aesthetic beauty, all the things that Arthur Conan Doyle lacks in his writing ability.
Mm-hmm.
Fandom is attempting to engage us with the miracle worker, who, whether that, again, is Doctor Who, Tony Stark, or Sherlock. Okay? And this is, just as an aside, this is also part of why I find myself dissatisfied with attempts to claim superheroes as modern mythology, because I think that mythology is operates out of a classical storytelling model, whereas the fandom thing is a very different impulse and a more modern one in many ways. But that might be a subject for another episode.
Okay.
Okay, so that's number one. And then number two, we need to accept that whatever need or pleasure fandom serves, it's a different need than our literary need. So in other words, I said a moment ago or a little bit ago that I think that this, our draw to fandom comes out of a religious impulse and that that's a natural thing and that's good, but it doesn't meet our need for classical storytelling, which I think we as humans also mm-hmm. have. We have this need to engage with literature and storytelling and all of that. This goes to my dissatisfaction with something you hear a lot these days, which is, it doesn't matter what you read, just read. And I want to say, no, it does matter what you read, because if you're only reading fandom stuff, that's great, except that you're not engaging with your other needs to engage with literature and ideas and mm-hmm. classical storytelling. You know, so recognize that you have both of those needs inside of you and engage both of them. And along those lines, I think that when fandom largely or wholly replaces either our literary or our religious needs, if we're complete nutcases and become like Jedi religion or whatever those people are, mm-hmm. then it ultimately becomes unhealthy. It's an amalgamation of both, that religious impulse and literary impulse. And it can complement both of those. It can complement our religious energy. It can complement our literary energy. But it shouldn't replace them. And the more we understand that, the more we understand where the impulse towards fandom comes from, the better we are able to accept fandom for what it really is. You know, enjoy your superheroes. Don't feel guilty about that. Don't feel guilty about the fact that you like reading Sherlock stories, even though Arthur Conan Doyle's a crappy writer. Don't feel guilty about the fact that you enjoy Doctor Who, even though the plots are just atrocious. You know, it's okay to say, no, I enjoy this because it's coming out of this fandom impulse, which is an okay thing to have. Mm-hmm. But then also part of recognizing that is saying, but it's good to keep that in proportion and to recognize that, okay, I need to read more than just comic books. I need to watch more than just Doctor Who reruns. Mm-hmm. You know, that there's a need to engage with higher literary value. Or at least with other literary value, if we'll keep the higher part out for the sake of avoiding value judgments okay. at the moment. And also with your religious needs as well. You know, don't fandom complement, should complement your storytelling needs and literary needs. It should complement or can complement your religious needs, but it should not replace either.
Perfect, Ben.
And that's right. Where we leave it.
I mean, I think the audience would agree with me and putting their hands together for Ben DeBono. Here it is.
Well, thank you, sir. Good things happen on a bike.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Well, if you're done with that, I want to quickly say this.
It's all right. Christian story time.
Ben, take a quick look over to your left.
Uh-oh, baby. Baby crib.
I built a crib.
All right. How'd that go?
And left it in our studio.
Have you tested it?
I haven't. No babies yet. But yeah, we're basically just using it as storage for all the baby shower gifts for now.
Actually, those probably weigh more than the baby.
That's true. So I think so it's going to be safe. Yeah. So next up, by the time you get here next week, where this chair is and this box piled on top, this is going to be where her dresser is.
Yeah.
By her, I mean my baby.
Right.
It's going to be a female.
Yeah.
I think I've said that before.
I think so.
So what do you think? How do you like my my crib building skills?
I think you're nailing it.
Do you have any, since we are here in story time, we're talking about babies, do you have any funny baby stories from the last, how long has it been?
Oh, 10 days? Yeah, something like that. I don't know. He slept, like, because he was a week and a half early. In fact, his due date would be tomorrow.
Oh.
And sometimes when they're early like that, they just kind of, they're very, very sleepy for the first week or two. So he hasn't really done much yet, but that's okay, you know. We've been hanging out together. We've been reading some Shakespeare together.
Oh, you already are reading Shakespeare?
Not out loud to him.
Oh.
I've been reading Shakespeare while he sleeps on me.
Why don't you read out loud if you're going to anyways?
It takes more time.
All right. All right, Ben. Well,
I feel a little self-conscious about reading Shakespeare to a baby.
I guess that makes sense.
But by the way, I want to Send out a huge congratulations to our friend Daniel Ford.
Yeah.
Who texted me this morning that his son said the word squirrel for the first time today.
So, oh, well, hey.
Congratulations to the Ford family. That's a moment to make any parent proud.
Well, that's up from here. Well, I guess just say congratulations, Ford family.
Yeah.
I'm Matt Anderson.
I'm Ben DiBono.
We are the Sci-Fi Christians signing off.
Oh, goodbye. Keep those squirrel stories coming.
Let's go ahead and record. I think we should rename it. I think Cult of...
The Cult of Sherlock.
It's pretty good. So do you want to do 287?
Yep. Ready? Episode 287, The Cult of Sherlock.
And I'll just edit that back to the beginning. You had a really good idea for this title. Do you remember it?
Sherlock the Great and Terrible.
Okay.
I think it was the one you liked.
Did you like one better?
No, I liked them all.
Okay.
I only would have sent ones I liked.
All right, I'm ready.
What number is
87.
It? Episode 287. Sherlock the Great and Terrible.